The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
It is more difficult, obviously, to manage this virus with the new Delta variant. But crucially, after two doses of vaccine, we are confident that you get the same protection as you did with the old variant.
The Delta variant, which originated in India, is proving a major obstacle to the easing of restrictions around the world. But did major governments do enough to stop the COVID strain from taking hold? Plus, the security expert Michael Clark will tell us why NATO wants to use a base in Qatar to train Afghan special forces. Bloomberg's Ewan Potts will have a roundup of the day's main business stories. And then...
Hello, Tom. Me and our LATAM affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott will be talking about vaccine rollout in Brazil, the role of women in organized crime in Mexico, and we even have some good news.
We always need some good news. More from Fernando Augusto Pacheco later. All that and more ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. One of India's top public health experts, Dr. Subhash Salunkhe, says officials failed to heed his warning in March that a new variant of COVID-19 was spreading rapidly throughout a rural area of the country. That variant, which has since been named Delta, has gone on to wreak havoc within India's borders and has now become the dominant strain of the virus throughout much of the world. We're going to explore this further now with Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Good afternoon to you, Chris. Great to speak with you as always. And we'll come on to some of the challenges globally in managing or dealing with the strain in a second. But just to pick up on that point about potential mismanagement of its development in India, what did you make of Dr. Subhash Salunkhe's comments? He was suggesting that as early as March, and let's remember, this is when India was still on the green list for travel, certainly to the UK, for example, he warned all the relevant authorities about what was happening and that nothing happened. What do you make of his claims?
Well, we've known about the Indian variant subtype 1, 2 and 3 for a number of months, actually, well before we became really exercised about it in the UK, because it appeared as a blip on the radar, but one among many. And people thought, well, yes, there's this blip on the radar. Yes, there's this variant in India. But actually, what's accounting for most of the activity there is the Kent variant, the UK-born strain of coronavirus with its enhanced transmissibility. And so it took a while before people realised that what was accounting for the very voracious spread of the infection across India was that they had a new variant or a clutch of variants there, some of which did have even more enhanced transmissibility and were probably accounting, apart from a number of other social factors, for rapid spread. But the thing is, there are many voices in this, and sometimes when people do shout, they're not heard. If one casts one's mind back to this time last year and earlier, we had the doctor, Dr. Li in China, who said, there is something happening here in Wuhan. I've seen lots of patients with this very strange condition, which is leading to very progressive, very serious symptoms, and people are losing their lives. He was, of course, given a public order offence by the Chinese authorities before he then unfortunately succumbed to the very disease he tried to raise awareness of himself. So there are many instances across this unfortunately sorry story where people do try to bring things to people's attention and they're not always heard.
Well, yeah, and I suppose hindsight's a wonderful thing. There are many warnings, and some do indeed prove to be unfounded. So it is hard for those people running health authorities, National Centres for Disease Control, I guess, to know exactly which warnings they should heed with the greatest alacrity. If we then throw it forwards or bring things up to date then, Chris, you know, we see here in this country that the sort of June 21st reopening postponed, delayed again, because the government is not confident that they yet have enough information about the impact of this variant. What do you make of that decision? That, I can imagine, you'll probably say, well, look, that seems to have scientific efficacy.
Well, obviously, I'm disappointed like everybody else. I was looking forward to us getting back to more normal than we have been. I mean, we're not going to be normal by any means anyway, but I was looking forward to getting there. And so it is a psychological dent. But I can understand the reasoning behind this, and I can understand why they have taken the path that they have. And it all stems from the fact that the current roadmap was drawn up with, in mind, the trajectory of vaccination and the trajectory of spread and cases caused by opening up, when we're talking about the traditional Kent variant that had until that time been accounted for perhaps 96-99% of the coronavirus diagnoses in the UK. Now, with the arrival on our shores of the Indian variant subtype 2, which we're calling Delta, that has an additional transmission advantage over the Kent variant. So it's even more transmissible. And that meant that actually when they looked at the seesaw of increasing cases of virus being balanced by other measures, vaccination, and the trajectory of vaccination, suddenly where the two had been meeting and the vaccines would have headed off what was going on with the cases, because this other variant was on our shores and was rampaging through the population far more quickly than the models had accounted for, it meant we would have ended up in a position where the vaccines wouldn't head off that surge in the way that the modelling had hoped. So they had to act. And what they're saying is that we buy ourselves 4 weeks more time while we don't load the seesaw up with any more risk yet, but we do enhance the other end of the seesaw, the vaccine end, by increasing the rate of vaccination and increasing the scope of vaccination. That will hopefully bring us to a point where in 4 weeks' time, the number of people who can catch and become seriously unwell with coronavirus has been dramatically reduced, because we've got double doses, which was the other fly in the ointment. We realised we needed to double dose people with vaccines. One wasn't going to cut it. We needed both doses. That enables us to reach a much more favourable position by the 19th of July, which is why they've set that date. Let's hope that, as Boris Johnson said, you know, that is the last great heave that we have to do, and it's not going to be the last great heave until the next one.
Yeah, and Chris, I guess a lot of people will be trying to work out in their minds what this sort of balancing act looks like between the greater transmissibility, as you said, but then a seemingly potentially diminished impact, because some admittedly laypersons might say, well, look, does it matter if there is a big surge in cases, provided we don't see a huge increase in hospitalizations or in people who become gravely ill? Is that to misrepresent or to misinterpret what we're seeing? Or is part of this process that we see in the development of these variants, and we will continue to see, greater transmissibility by definition, but also a diminishing clinical impact over time? That's kind of how these things, it's kind of how they shape up, right?
It's the pattern that these sorts of things tend to follow over time. Yes, that's right. But we obviously don't know at the moment. So what they're doing is taking a cautionary approach while we're not knowing what this thing is capable of. And also making sure that we have got double doses into people who are not off the bottom end of the risk list. Because there are still people, remember, we've got 55% of the population who have had two doses of the vaccine. And we have prioritised the people who are at the greatest risk for both doses. But there are still people at the bottom of that distribution who are at potentially some risk. And 55% means that, therefore, 45% of the population still could catch and could become unwell with this coronavirus. And if you've got 45% of people who could catch it, that's quite a big spike. And that could then inject the infection into other sectors of society, including those who have been vaccinated but haven't responded to the vaccine. We'd still end up with a big spike in cases, which is what they're trying to head off at the moment. And so what one hopes is that longer term, this will arrive at a point where we have done our best by everybody to protect everybody as best we can. And then we start embracing a mindset of, we have to manage this like the flu. And how have we managed the flu? We know who the susceptible people are. We know who the most vulnerable are. We know what the virus is doing because there's a surveillance network around the world that keep an eye on it and test what the vaccine is doing versus what the virus is doing and update one according to the other. And then we prioritise certain groups for getting that vaccine in the autumn. This is no different. And I foresee that we need to be aiming for a situation where we will control this in the same way, where people make their own judgment about whether they want to catch the flu or not, or how whatever risk they're going to take. Same with COVID, but we take steps to protect those that we judge to be at highest risk were they to run into the infection. But I think until we get to a stage where we have best protected everybody with what we have at our disposal now, that's the point at which we say, right, we've done everything we absolutely possibly can. Now we have to encourage people to make a risk judgment, a risk-benefit analysis really for themselves as to where they do and don't want to take risks in the future.
Yeah, Chris, thanks as always. Impeccable insights from Monocle's health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith. Now let's hear from Carlotta Ribello. She's here with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Tom. China has accused NATO of slandering its peaceful development after alliance leaders warned about systemic challenges coming from Beijing. NATO added that China's actions threaten the international order. It is the first time the alliance has placed China at the center of its agenda. The International Criminal Court has called for a full investigation into suspected crimes against humanity during a crackdown in the Philippines. The ICC opened a preliminary probe into the country's drugs war back in 2018, which led Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte to withdraw from the court. The UK's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has agreed a trade deal with his Australian counterpart, Scott Morrison. The new pact means that British products such as Scotch whisky and Welsh lamb would be cheaper to sell to Australia. But farmers are concerned about the deal. And after making cameras in Japan for more than 70 years, Nikon Corp is calling time on domestic production of its famed single-lens reflex cameras, which have been beloved by photojournalists ever since the Vietnam War. You can find out more by heading over to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Tom.
Thank you very much, Carlotta. Now, it's been revealed that NATO security officials have approached Qatar in a bid to secure a base that can be used to train Afghan special forces. It comes as the 36 countries involved in NATO's Resolute Support mission in Afghanistan are set to withdraw from the country. Well, let's get the latest now with Michael Clark, former head of the Royal United Services Institute. Good afternoon to you, Michael. Tell us, what exactly is being proposed here, a sort of mega training facility in Qatar? Does this come as a surprise, or do you think this is the sort of thing we might have been expecting?
Well, we knew that NATO have been looking around for places where they can offer, as it were, more remote support to the Afghan government after the pullout this summer. It's not really a surprise that they should turn towards Qatar. I mean, it's slightly surprising the way it's come out, because it's come out from two or three officials who wanted to speak anonymously, and the Secretary General of NATO, Stoltenberg, has confirmed that they are interested in Qatar. But it looks as if the Taliban didn't know anything about this, which is interesting. But so it's the announcement itself, or the way it's come out in the on the wires, has certainly surprised me this morning. But I'm not surprised at the development. I might have expected it to come out a little bit more formally. That's all, perhaps in due course.
Well, Michael, tell us a little bit then about how much or how little one should read into the location of this mooted facility then. As you mentioned, it's been a topic of discussion, and the sort of scouting around has happened. How does it shape, the effectiveness of the sort of the end game, of the training? Is it more important, frankly, as you've alluded to already, that other stakeholders are across it and engage with it? What kind of difference does it make where these things happen?
Well, it makes quite a big difference as to where it might happen. In that respect, Qatar is a very good choice if the Qataris are prepared to go with it, which I suspect they will be. Because, I mean, Qatar opened an office for the Taliban, remember, in 2013. You know, they stuck their necks out and said, yeah, we've got to contribute. I mean, Qatar is it's a very rich state, but it's a tiny, tiny state. And they said, we've got to try to contribute to peacemaking in Afghanistan. So they gave the Taliban an office in 2013. That's been the basis for the negotiations from 2017, 2018 between the Taliban and the Americans, which is the basis of this present pullout. And remember also, Qatar hosts the Al Udeid air base. In fact, it's more than an air base. It's called a KAOC, which is a combined air operations center. You've got to have the gift of the gab for this subject. It's a KAOC. And the KAOC at Al Udeid, which is about 30 miles west of Doha, is huge. I mean, there are 10,000 American service personnel at Al Udeid. That's more than the armed forces of Qatar itself. There's only 8,000 members of the Qatari army. And there's 10,000 Americans in the territory. And there's quite a few Brits. So that air base, which served a very big role in the wars in the Middle East, in Iraq and Afghanistan, is still there. And there's a big tradition of using it. So there's lots of reasons why, you know, you might turn to Qatar. And also, there's a thing called the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, which NATO has had on the go for almost 10 years now. And Qatar is a member of that. So is Bahrain and Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates. But the Qataris are the only ones, really, of those four who've really tried to use it. So they've tried to be useful. I mean, you know, Qatar is a small country. It does the right thing. It tries to be useful. And it gets a lot of criticism for it. It's got into big rows with some of its neighbours. It was blockaded by the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates from 2017 until earlier this year. That's only just recently been lifted. But they stick their necks out. They sometimes do the wrong thing, I have to say, but they usually do the right thing. And they look like, at the moment, the West's and NATO's most reliable ally in the Gulf. So it makes a certain amount of sense.
It does indeed. And I suppose it would be remiss of me not to ask you, Michael, to sort of gaze into the crystal ball somewhat. We've spoken on this programme and others before about, you know, the potential kind of unravelling of the security situation still further in Afghanistan post-withdrawal of some of the big stakeholders. Do you see or hear anything with these announcements and others that maybe ameliorate some concerns about how serious that unravelling could be?
Yes. I mean, what the West is trying to do, what NATO and the United States are trying to do, is to put in place mechanisms where they can help the Afghan government after the pullout. Now, you know, how much you can help if you're not physically there is open to question. But what they're saying is that, you know, we'll take Afghan special forces and give them an intensive 4 to 6 week training program at this foreign base, if it turns out to be Qatar. And the Americans, the British, the Turks, Turkish troops have said, apparently, that they're prepared to do this, which, you know, would be a good thing. And maybe other countries might collaborate. So helping to train Afghan special forces, one thing. The other thing that the allies are trying to do is to provide air bases so that they might be able to provide air support. Now, that's more controversial. And there's a lot of countries who are much more wary of providing bases for air operations over Afghanistan, because that's more sensitive. But providing a base for the training of special forces is less of a problem, and probably more relaxing. Or I think the Qataris will be more relaxed about that than they would be about having a lot of stuff fly off from Al Udeid to go and bomb Taliban positions in around Kandahar or something like that.
Yeah, indeed. Michael, really interesting stuff. Thanks for being with us today on the programme. That was the former head of the Royal United Services Institute, Michael Clark, joining us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. Well, time to get the latest business news. Next, I'm joined as usual by our good friend at Bloomberg, Ewan Potts. Ewan, good afternoon to you. An end, Ewan, in sight for a 17-year-old trade dispute between the US and the European Union. Tell us more.
Tom, it's been a fight with an $11.5 billion price tag. That's the value of the tariffs imposed by the US and the European Union on each other's aircraft exports. Now, finally, after 17 years, the two sides have agreed to patch up their differences. The accord turns the page on a key conflict in former President Donald Trump's trade war and sets the stage for a new era of transatlantic cooperation over state aid. Now, we understand that the deal means that all future passenger aircraft made by both Airbus and Boeing will be required to be developed without subsidies. The feud dates back to 2004 when the US lodged a legal case at the World Trade Organization against the EU, saying that they were subsidizing aircraft unfairly. In the other direction, the EU said that Boeing was benefiting from US subsidies as well as space and military contracts, which defrayed the cost of civilian aircraft development. But the two sides have finally agreed to stop all this. And I think this is driven in part, or at least in large measure, by the threat of China. There's growing awareness among policymakers in Brussels and Washington that China's state-sponsored aircraft manufacturer, Commercial Aircraft Corporation, is on track to become a legitimate rival in global plane making, probably as soon as the end of the decade. So they thought it was about time to stop their little tiff.
Indeed. Well, let's stay with trade. And we heard actually in the news headlines just a moment or two earlier about the Brits and the Aussies getting a deal done.
Yeah, the main elements of the pact were finalised at a dinner between Prime Minister Boris Johnson and Australian PM Scott Morrison. Boris Johnson calling it a new dawn in the UK's relationship with Australia. Fantastic opportunities for British business. The agreement is the first major deal by the UK that doesn't just roll over a pre-existing EU trade relationship. The deal is to cut tariffs on products like Scotch whisky, clothing and cars. It will also more controversially reduce levies on agricultural products, which is something which has sparked a backlash from Britain's farming sector. They've raised concerns that they'll be undercut by cheap meat imports from Australia. Under the terms of the deal, there will be a cap on tariff-free imports for 15 years. For Australia, it's a useful pivot away from China, which is, of course, by far its biggest trade partner and a political relationship which has gone pretty sour in recent years. But in terms of the significance for GDP, well, I'm afraid it is not significant. The Australia deal expected to boost the size of the UK economy by just 0.02%. over the next 15 years.
Now, before the end of the show, we're going to be heading for Brazil. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about Brazil yourself, Ewan. Just finally, battling inflation, how is Brazil faring?
Yeah, no central banker in the world is taking on price rises this year like Roberto Campos Neto. He's the head of Brazil's central bank. He shocked traders early this year with a bigger than expected rate hike of 75 basis points in March, 0.75 percentage point. And then he did another one back in May. It was a classic central banking gambit. Unleash a great show of force from the outset to prove you're a true inflation fighter. Bring down inflation expectations and perhaps ease the need for additional hikes. Unfortunately, the bold plan does not appear to be working. Inflation expectations have actually gone up, not down, in Brazil. A lot of things not really in his control. Large budget deficits, soaring global commodity prices, and a severe drought driving up electricity bills. But perhaps we may get to more aggressive rate hikes in future, or he may decide not to jeopardise Brazil's economic recovery. We'll just have to see how he moves next time.
We shall watch with a great deal of interest. Ewan, always good to hear from you. Thank you. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts joining us here on The Briefing, and we'll be heading back to Latin America right after this.
Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. A global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, we're hearing from two Novartis leaders who work as part of the Global Drug Development Organization under John Tsai, from whom we've heard from before. Jeff Lagos is the Global Head of Oncology Development at Novartis, and Andrea Myers is Global Program Head for Lung Cancer at Novartis. Jeff and Andrea are with us to share some of their extraordinary insights into the process and progress of identifying and treating lung cancer and improving outcomes for patients that are affected. Cancer is such a big emotive topic. What brought you to the roles you're now both in as leaders within Novartis R&D, especially in clinical development? Andrea Myers.
You know, it was a circuitous course, I would say. I am trained as a physician and a scientist, and cancer medicine and cancer science are just a compelling field to start with. As you pointed out, it's a very emotive disease, and so the care of patients with cancer, as well as really working with their families, is incredibly important role as a physician. So for that reason, it was a field of medicine that really was compelling to me as a clinician. At the time that I was starting my medicine and graduate school work, there really was an evolution in our understanding of the different ways that cancer can grow. And it was clear that there was going to be a real advance in the ways that we were taking care of patients with new medicines that were becoming much more focused and much more precise to take care of patients' very specific tumors. In my first year of medical school, there was a new medicine, imatinib, that was discovered to really transform patients who had a type of leukemia. And it clearly was going to be a game changer and a field that was going to be rapidly evolving. So from my time in medical school, I transitioned to taking care of patients and then working in the lab to further understand these different ways that cancers can be grown and potentially treated. And in that path, really made the transition to industry, recognizing that there was just an incredible number of decisions and important decisions being made, taking these new medicines to patients. And in that, really landed in the field of lung cancer, given the very compelling science and transformation that's happening, particularly in this field. Of course, lung cancer is also the leading cancer killer. So there is a clear reason to want to offer our science and our medicine, particularly in this field.
Andrea Myers, Global Program Head of Lung Cancer at Novartis. An enduring commitment for more than a quarter of a century. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with the briefing on Monocle 24. Finally, as promised, on today's programme, we're going to round up some of the biggest stories across Latin America. Monocle senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with me in the studio. And our Latin America affairs correspondent Lucinda Elliott joins us on the line from Uruguay's capital, Montevideo. Good morning to you, Lucinda. Good afternoon to you, Fernando. Great to have you both with us. And I'll start, Faye, with you. We were talking about inflationary pressures in Brazil just a moment ago with you and Potts. The vaccine rollout. We've tracked the ins and outs of this story. Not necessarily the slowest across the continent, but it's pretty sluggish. Tell us where we're at.
And it's pretty patchy as well, because we don't have kind of a national program. So different states are performing in different ways. And the interesting thing here, Tom, I was looking at two states that are doing very well. One of them is my state, São Paulo, which is the wealthiest state in Brazil. So the governor, João Dória, said that, you know, his initial timeline that he wanted all adults vaccinated by the end of October. Now he brought it a bit forward to September, in fact. So it's going faster than predicted. But then, Tom, I was looking, is it because São Paulo is the wealthiest state? Not really, because the poorest state in Brazil, Maranhão in the northeast, they're also doing very well. The capital of the state, São Luís, I think they start vaccinating people under 30 as well. And then I was like, what's bringing those two people together? They're from different political affiliations. One is from the right, one is from the left. They basically, there's a political kind of, they want to control the pandemic. They reinforced lockdowns. So they did everything that Bolsonaro didn't do. So actually the answer is very simple. They just really kind of took care of their population. They really prioritized buying vaccines for their own states. And that's very interesting. I mean, there's no magical solution here. And that's why those two very different states are doing well, actually, with the vaccine.
A shocking headline, Fernando.
Yes, it's just obvious.
Political decision-making can actually deal with even the worst crisis.
Absolutely.
Who knew? Well, it seems everybody. Lucinda, let me bring you in here, maybe to react to that shocking development. But I did want to ask you about something really interesting, which I know you've been musing on recently, and that's a little north. Looking at organised crime, of course, in Mexico, and you've been writing about the wife of El Chapo. I'm sure people have seen the Netflix docs and been reading the well, shocking, but always grimly compelling details, of course, out of newspaper reportage. Tell us a bit about the role women play in organised crime. It's really interesting stuff.
Yeah, so El Chapo's cartel wife, Emma Coronel, she appears to have stayed loyal to the end. Last week, she actually pleaded guilty in a US court to drug and money laundering charges. And ever since her arrest back in February, there's been this widespread speculation that the former beauty pageant winner would sort of spill her husband's secrets in exchange for leniency. Yet there was no hint of that in the 9-page plea deal that she'd signed up. I mean, the sentence is yet to be determined. But she did acknowledge that after 3 years after she became Goodsman's third or possibly fourth wife, that she helped him to smuggle huge quantities of drugs into the US. She did concede that she helped him to break out of a Mexican prison, which he's most famous for. Back in 2015, but she didn't really spill the beans like many had assumed. And so what this story has really highlighted and what I have been looking into this week is the role of women in organized crime. And it's been fascinating to look back on several women who have made their way up in the cartel chain of command in Mexico, and also how historically they're just viewed as these subordinate figures, you know, who go out to shop, who go to the gym, who look after the kids, when actually they're involved in the day-to-day running of these illicit businesses. And Mrs. Goodman appears to be one of those, at least.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story, isn't it? And I did want to ensure that we, as ever on the programme, bring a little light along with some shade. So we were going to end, Fernando promised this at the top of the show, we'd end with some good news. And Lucinda, there is a bit of a reopening story, still delayed here in the UK, but that's not true everywhere. And if we look to the Galapagos, reopening could be on the cards.
Yeah, so the ultimate wildlife destination has reopened to vaccinated animal lovers. So travellers with two doses and a negative test can visit the islands. This is partly because residents there have also been protected now from COVID. But Ecuador was one of the first countries last year to close its borders immediately on registering a case. It has a new president, Guillermo Lasso, a conservative, and he wants to restart the tourism industry. And it's a beautiful place. I mean, it's got spring-like weather that lasts year-round, so I'd really recommend to anyone if they can make it there, particularly those who haven't visited South America before.
I want to go there, actually.
I was going to ask you, Fernando. It's definitely on my one-day wish list.
And you know what? You know, we're almost double vaccinated, Tom. Maybe I don't know if I could have said that.
We can do a little work trip, maybe. A jolly for both of us. We can meet Lucinda over there. It'll be a lovely, lovely, merry time. And Faye, you have some good news to tell us as well. This is from the cultural realm. Tell us why this is important.
It's magical news for me, actually. We're talking here about Marisa Monte. She's a legendary Brazilian singer. Not sure if Lucinda, maybe Lucinda's a fan. Are you a fan, Lucinda?
Yeah, massive fan. Tribalistas, all the way. Yeah.
See, she's special. I mean, her last album was more than a decade ago. So she's a bit like Kate Bush here in the UK. She doesn't release albums that often, but when she does, it's a massive success. And her music's not the usual chart toppers in Brazil. She has a very soothing voice. It's very calming. I mean, even her new song is related to that in a way. So yeah, that made me extremely happy.
Very good news. I'm excited to hear a little, and I'll let you introduce it in just a second, Fernando. But we close on the end of the show. Lucinda, huge thanks for joining us. That was our correspondent in Latin America, Lucinda Elliott. My thanks to her. Thanks to all the team behind today's programme. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. And our studio manager was Louis Allen. We'll be back, of course, at the same time tomorrow. Don't forget to listen to the Monocle Daily a little later, coming up at 1800 London, 1900 CET. That's all from me, Tom Edwards. Fernando, do the honours. Play us out with some Marisa Monte. What have we got?
This is Marisa Monte with Calma.
Assim, não diga que não gosta de mim, não diga que não vai me